Riese und Müller Unplugged. The podcast for everything that gets us in motion.
Hello and welcome to a new episode in our podcast Riese und Müller Unplugged. My name is Julie Jankowski and on this channel we're talking to people working for Riese und Müller in their way of working. Today I'll be talking to Sandra Wolf. Sandra is CEO at Riese und Müller, so she's part of the management board. And her perspective is mainly driven by strategic thoughts and innovation. So I'm very glad to have her here. Hello Sandra, how are you doing today?
Hello, Jule, and thank you for being with you. I'm fine, thank you. Sun is shining, and I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah, we've been talking shortly, and you told me that you just did some biking today already, nearly 50K today, and it's pretty hot, so...
Yeah, it was almost, I would say, end of the day, I will have 50 kilometers riding from A to B, from work to the studio here and back and then back home. And I rode everything with my cargo bike. So, and it's pretty hot today, but I'm not sweating.
You're not sweating. Yeah. Okay. So we're recording today in a remote motor, so it might be a little bit, I don't know if the technique is going to, but it sounds quite good at the moment, so hopefully we get through it. The subtitle of our podcast is what gets you in motion. So my first question for you is, what gets you in motion at Riese und Müller, Sandra?
Yeah, as you said, I'm the CEO of Riese und Müller, and as most of the people who work with us know is that Riese und Müller has three CEOs, which is somewhat unusual because usually a company has one CEO and the other is doing other stuff. But this is very democratic at Riese und Müller. And so we said we are three people in the management. So we are three people that are in charge and three CEOs. So I'm in next to Heiko Müller and Markus Riese in the management team, and happy to be with these two guys who founded Riese und Müller and really bringing the whole business into motion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and the story about the founding will be our first topic we are touching. So we promised to disclose some back-end stories of your company, and probably one of the most interesting stories indeed is the founding itself. How did it start? I heard there were some minor analogies to founding of Apple, keyword garage.
Yeah, it was definitely a garage where Heiko and Markus founded Riese und Müller. However, I always say that it was never their target to found a company. It was their target to build bikes, and it's still their target to build bikes. And to get back to the founding story, in 1993, Heiko and Markus met at the University of Darmstadt a couple of years before, both studying mechanical engineering. And they realized that the two of them really like bikes, and both of them as engineers like to work with bikes, change things, make them better, optimizing things. And then they decided to go to a trip to Tunisia. I always ask them why Tunisia, because I think at this time and still today, Tunisia is not the first country you would think of a bike trip. But they went to Tunisia and traveled 4 weeks on their bikes. They changed a lot before they did this travel to really optimize their bikes, to go through the desert and to stand the heat, to make it a safe trip. And during this trip, they kind of strongly grew together and thought it might be also a good idea to work with bikes in the future. And Markus was the one who had the idea of a folding bike. And this is very much about what we are doing today. It's not the folding bike, but it's the idea of changing daily biking, because they wanted to have a bike that you can use on your extra mile. Let's say after a trip with a train, you want to go somewhere, you don't want to use a taxi, but you have your bike with you. And to have a folding bike that rides as good as a normal bike, and that was their mission, and that is what they developed, both of them. And after first prototyping, they always thought big and went with the bike to an exhibition, found someone who was able to produce the frame for them and the bike for them. And this was kind of the start in the garage of Heiko's parents. It was the start of Riese & Müller.
And this garage still exists.
This garage still exists, and the parents are still very proud of their two boys.
So do they have a hall of fame within the entrance hall with all the pictures of the first days?
Yeah, kind of. And as you look at the story of Riese & Müller, it was always a story of friendship and family. So the first employees were kind of the parents, because not only they had to stand all that noise, because also the office, the first office, CEO office, was in Heiko's Kinderzimmer, so in his room, and Heiko's mother did the accounting. Then Marcus' parents also worked with the company. Friends came and helped them whenever there was a need. Then first exhibitions, they found friends who helped them on the exhibition. So the whole story of Riese & Müller in the first years was about family and friendship. So Heiko and Marcus are friends, and then the family helped them to really found the company and to make it a company, and not only an idea that is over after a couple of months or a couple of years.
So they started their business within their university time. So that was a huge, gigantic jump into business at that stage, and connected with a lot of risk. And I think it takes a lot to be brave enough to start this business. What would you say? Is it still is it typical for Heiko and Marcus to be brave and strategic looking at business?
I wouldn't call it strategic. It's more that I think still Riese & Müller is what I said. It's a company that is based on friendship and based off on family values. We are based on innovation and innovative ideas. We never miss a reason to be innovative. We don't want to be mainstream. And of course, the whole story shows that there was always a kind of a vision, but coming out of the gut feeling and coming out of a kind of being brave and want to jump into the next step. So yeah, I would say it's definitely something brave at that time and still today.
There's another expression which comes to my mind, and this is, expression is passion. For me, it sounds a lot of passion, passion for biking, passion for high-end technology and bike performance, and a sustainable lifestyle, which is still, I think, very up-to-date for you. Are these the core values of your culture, besides friendship and family?
Yeah, you can name it. I think sustainability, I think in the beginning we wouldn't have called it sustainability. But if you build bikes and your lifestyle is based on cycling and not on too much on sportive cycling, but on really ditching cars and bringing cars out of the cities, then yeah, that's one part of sustainability. On the other hand, as I said, they founded a company with very limited resources, being financially or being like physical resources. Like we said, it was the first office was Heiko's children's room. The first workshop was the garage. So it's based on a resource sensitive like mindset, which both of them have, and today we would call it a sustainable lifestyle. And their passion and our passion for cycling is what still drives us. Is even though we are really a big company now, it was never the reason of Heiko and Marcus to really build a company that makes a lot of money and in the end maybe sell it for a lot of money. It was always and is still the idea still is to build the best bikes.
How would you describe the culture? You started it when I entered Riesenmüller, so I get the feeling it's not really corporate. It's more like, what do you call it, friendship. It's down to earth. So there is no distinction between production and administration. Maybe you can just describe what it looks like when you come to your company.
I think, and I was asked that a couple of weeks ago, from another journalist, I think we are a very human company, and it all goes down to having a human style. And so we do a lot not to make any difference between people, and we do a lot that the people really like the way we do business and the place they work at.
Yeah, you're not talking about human resources. You call it people and culture. So this is maybe one example of what is so specific in the way of working together. So when have you joined the company? When did you enter Riesenmüller?
Officially, I entered Riesenmüller in 2013, but years before, I was already kind of working with Riesenmüller, and I'm in the bike business already since 20 years. So yeah, 2013.
So absolutely familiar. So what ways of looking at things did you bring to Riesenmüller? What is your perspective, so to say? What did you bring extra additionally to this specific culture?
I still think that I didn't bring anything specifically to the company, but what I brought maybe is that I want to keep the culture. And Heiko and Marcus, they never thought about any values or is it a value, they just did it. And when you grow, and we grew very fast, we still grow very fast, then you need to know what your values are and have the definition of the values and really see how you can bring it to the people, because otherwise your culture is lost. So I think I brought to this company a very clear view what is valuable and how we can bring it to the people and keep it today and keep it in the future. A second perspective, I think you mentioned it in the beginning, I definitely see my position as a strategic one, looking into the future, seeing opportunities, seeing risks also, and try to find a structure and organizing the company around these potentials and risks.
And what do you say has your culture developed? How has it developed or has it changed within the last couple of years? What have you observed within your 7 or 8 years?
I think what I really like is that we grew, and when I started, we were around 35 people. Today, we are 550.
Wow.
Over the last 7 years, we changed a lot, but in the end, it was a very harmonious and very, very good growth, a very healthy growth. And this is something that I really bring it back to the founding values. Let's say friendship. Of course, it's not 550 friends, and we all have good days and bad days. It's very human, so we also have our conflicts, of course. But I think that's exactly what friendship means, and we try to keep the values of friendship, which means we have a respectful togetherness. We try to be very open, we try to be critical, and we try to be very human. So that's also the reason why we call human resources today people and culture, because we see that it's about every single person in the company. It's not just about one group of people or it's about one hierarchy of people. It's really about everybody. And we saw that it's so important that everybody finds his or her home. And so everybody has the right to be seen, and therefore also the Department of Human Resources or People and Culture is quite big. We are almost 15 people because we saw that we need people to care for people. And this is what I really developed over the last year. And even though growth means also that there's a lot of flexibility needed, a lot of change management needed. But I think we are a great bunch of people. We have a great culture. I enjoy every day I really go to the company.
So you have a lot of diversity in your company. It's not just one hoodie wearing, jeans wearing, a kind of mechanical engineer in your company. So you have a whole variety of characters.
Yeah, hoodies is really a lot of people wear hoodies, and a lot of people who came in the first day with a kind of a suit or a shirt changed within a couple of days or weeks to a hoodie and jeans. So that's kind of corporate fashion at Wiesenmüller, definitely. It's very leger, very sportive at Wiesenmüller. And we have a very big variety of people. We have almost 40 or even more nationalities at Wiesenmüller. We have women, we have men, we have every kind of age. We are really a great crowd of people that bring a lot into the company.
Well, and a wide range of competences, I guess. So it's not only that you come from a business perspective or a mechanical perspective either, so you have different competences in the background. Is it correct?
That's absolutely correct. And that was also one of the targets, not to stay too much into one area, to have only people coming from the bike business or only bike engineers. We have a great variety of people from whatever we have. It's like people that used to work as a pilot before and they now work in our production. We have people that worked in a bank and now work in our accounting. We have every kind of competency and every kind of experience, from no experience to 30 or more years of experience.
So that's a great mixture and a whole variety of competences, of characters, of attitudes, and a great mindset, what I think so, what I observe when I come to your company. Talking in strategic dimensions, your company has decided to focus on e-bikes at a very early point of time when the success story of e-bikes could not have been overlooked so clearly as it is nowadays. Would you say it is a typical Wiesenmüller? It's a typical attitude to aim for far-reaching goals? This is moment of being brave. Would you say it's typical for Wiesenmüller?
It's typical for Wiesenmüller that we take opportunities. And at that time, which was in 2012, 2013, a little bit earlier when we started to think about, we knew that it's the only possibility to be, to grow and to have an impact, to really put the full focus on e-bikes. And at that time, we were really very little, 20 employees, something like that, 3,000 pieces a year, and a very highly engineered product. And we knew that the combination of this highly engineered product and a motor is the best fit. And as we never saw an e-bike as a bike for people who are not able to ride a bike anymore, a normal bike, we knew that it will really change the mobility of the future and how mobility in the cities will work. This is something that we really knew, and we kind of waited for this opportunity, and we just we took the opportunity. And at that time it was brave, because as I said, we were very little, and we completely got rid of our portfolio of non-e-bikes within one season and change to e-bikes. And I would say that building e-bikes is different from building normal bikes. So we also changed our production processes. The volume all of a sudden is much higher, because you have a component, which is the engine, that is much, much more expensive than all the components we had before. So it was a high invest also. But yes, it was brave.
That was absolutely brave. And how did the market react? I mean, you skipped nearly 90% of your portfolio. What was the reaction from your trading partners?
At that time, you had definitely people who saw it the same way, like also Bosch as their producer of the motors. Of course, you had people that doubted that it's the correct decision, and you had people that were wondering what we are doing, if we are crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah, but I think we did it in a kind of a good way. So people were very quickly convinced that we are doing the right thing, and others, of course, did the same then in the future, in the next years.
And at what time did you introduce cargo bikes? Was it very early, or how long did it take to introduce this kind of bike?
It was 2015 when we introduced the first load. So 2 to 3 years later. And also this was kind of new. Mm-hmm. I remember at that time a friend of mine of Argentina visited me, and she she didn't know what kind of bike this is. She didn't like see the reason why one should ride a bike like this. And the same when in 2015 you rode with a cargo bike in the city or outside the city, people looked at you, and this completely changed. I mean, today I think almost everybody knows what a cargo bike is.
It's a common picture in urban lifestyle. Exactly. You see it everywhere. But just within the last, I would say last 1 or 2 years, it has become very common, not really outstanding. So would you say that was a starting point to put sustainability and a sustainable lifestyle more in the focus of your strategic action?
No, I think it started earlier, because as I said, we always lived a kind of a sustainable company culture. We always looked what we do, and we always kind of forced also people to ride bike. At that time, we definitely knew that it's not enough to only ride a bike, and it's not enough as a company to build bicycles for people who change their lifestyle into a sustainable lifestyle. And we said we have to do more, and we wanted to have a greater impact. And when you are bigger, people listen more to what you say. That's a fact. And we knew that we really have to make use of this growth also, that people listen and that companies need to change something. And of course, if you want people to do something, you have to do it yourself. And we said, okay, we can do more. At that time, we also planned our new building. We wanted to be the sustainable building, and we want to definitely focus much, much more and with much more projects on the sustainability topic, which we call responsibility, by the way, at Resimbola.
Just about to mention it. It's corporate responsibility, what you're describing. And can you please name some current projects, what you do to foster sustainability within your company? Because it's a kind of buzzword. Everybody wants to be sustainable and claims to live sustainability. But I think you have current projects going on to foster sustainability within your company.
Yeah, in 2019, we came up with a vision that we want to be the most sustainable e-bike manufacturer in the business. At that time, it was important for us to have a mission and a vision, and to really name it, and to kind of awake also the business, the bike business, the bike industry, because we want many players in the business to be with us. And we said we want to achieve this by 2025. At that time, nobody knew what it means to be the most sustainable manufacturer. And I think personally, it's not essential if you exactly name it. It's important to go on this road trip and to start with something. And when you ask me what kind of projects do you realize for 2020, we said we really want to focus on two topics. One is zero waste and the other one is zero emission. And we discussed that in our other talk that, of course, it's not possible as a human being and as a company to have no emission and no waste, but we want to have it reduced or don't produce it if possible. And we have a lot of projects. We started in the inside. We looked at our whole production process and looked which kind of packaging, for example, we can use. Packaging that we get in from our suppliers, for example, is completely reused in our whole production process and resending process to our dealers. And if you go to outside of Wiesenmüller, we talk to all of our suppliers about how they pack our products. We analyzed how they pack it, how does the products come to our company, how are they packed, how difficult it is to unpack the products, and where we can reduce the packaging material and how we can reuse the packaging material. And a very nice project, which I really like and which also came from our employees, is that we use a lot of packaging material. We bought a machine to make the packaging smaller, and then we can use these little pieces to repack our single little products that we spare parts, for example, that we send to our dealers. And this is really a kind of full usage of packaging material that comes mm-hmm. into our company. Of course, we produce high-end products, and if you go to the packaging from us to our dealers, we try to optimize it, but as it's a high-end product that in the end has to have a high quality, we need to pack it. But we look that also the transport way is less emission. We try to have a packaging that is from recycled materials, and this is what we currently all analyze and see how we can improve and try to have really less waste and on the other hand less emissions, which is easier this year than it was before.
So it sounds to me like an ongoing constant effort or journey of a constant effort where you maybe never reach the perfect goal of no emission, as you described it, which is unrealistic, or no waste, but as less waste as possible. And what would you say, is it more strain and stress or more driven by intrinsic motivation to push sustainability to a next level?
I personally would say it's very intrinsic. And when I see the motivation of our employees with this topic, I would also say it's extremely intrinsic. And I did a lot of projects at Wiesenmüller, and I did a lot of also, in my eyes, very great projects like the building of the new factory and things like that. But this project, like the introduction of the whole sustainability roadmap and all of the measurements we do and all of the workshops we did with the employees, there's so much power and so much energy in it, and people are so happy to help and have great ideas that it's really one of my best projects at Wiesenmüller.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Sounds like all in. So sustainability is a topic which has been somehow paused in the open discussion, to my observation, or in my observation, keyword COVID-19. So that was the time when the people stopped talking about sustainability, but they lived sustainability. What is your interpretation of it? What do we say? Does it have an impact, or did it have an impact, COVID-19, on consuming behavior?
It definitely has an impact, and I think there's different perspectives. One is that people are forced to live a sustainable lifestyle because all of a sudden it's not possible to fly anywhere in the world. To go to shops, there was a long period where it was even not possible to go to a shop. And all of a sudden, many people realize that they don't need the many things they thought they need. And it kind of feels good to buy less or to fly less. And then all of a sudden also change their lifestyle. I just heard that also, at least in Germany, the meat consumption is lower now because people buy more vegan meat or more fruits and more vegetables. So I think there's a lot of change right now. We have to see if it re-changes, if things get better or not. But I think it's a big open window to go into a more sustainable lifestyle. And as we all know, cycling is very popular all over the world, and this is something that is really great to see. It's not in the countries where cycling was always very popular, like in the Netherlands or in Denmark or in Germany. You see it all over the world that the infrastructure is changing, that people see it as a great possibility to fight the virus, but also to make the inner city infrastructure better, have less cars in the streets. So I think it's a weird combination of the good and the bad at the same time. And the bad sometimes digs out the good. And I hope that this really lasts for a while or even changes the whole behavior.
So more than a hype. So fighting the virus and fighting the body weight and supporting health could be a perspective on that. Urban lifestyle, infrastructure, what would you expect? How will it change within the next couple of years? I mean, there's a very close connection between mobility on the one hand and the way urban surroundings look like, and even in the more rural countryside. What would you expect? What will be the major changes within this topic?
I think major changes will be that people and politicians are now forced to do something. And they were not forced to do something a couple of months before. It was something that they had on their agenda, but they were not, they said, okay, is it today or next year or in 5 years? And all of a sudden it was really, really necessary to change it and to make use of the situation. And in the beginning, I was not sure if this is a long-lasting or rather a short thing or for a couple of months. But I think now that things will change, and I also see cities changing. And this means that we really, really have to get rid of that many cars in the cities. And if it's a bike or if it's other ways of moving people, that's, I don't care in a way. Of course, I'm happy if it's more bikes, but I think everybody knows now that cities really, really have to change, because it's too much in the cities, too many cars in the city, dangerous for the health of the people and for the safety of the people. And I think, and I really hope maybe, I hope it more than I really know it, of course, that that if you have ambassadors and cities or countries that really live it and live it for a longer future, then it will really change the future.
So when we throw perspective on our future, what is a contribution of Riese Möller? What would you say are topics which are gets you in motion in terms of future subjects?
Yeah, I hope that we forever, our mission is to build bikes and not to like grow because of the money. And with this development, I really hope that we can also change things. And I'm really into working with politicians. I really want to name our ideas, and I really hope that we stay in friendship and that we can bring the human perspective of mobility into the world and change it. And this really moves me, because I see this, as I said, open window right now, and I'm really enthusiastic of changing things and not having changed anything before the window closes. And that's my biggest fear at the same time, that maybe this window closes and we all say, oh, now it's closed. So I think everybody who has a voice can do something and can really, if it's mobility or if it's sustainability or if it's looking at the people it doesn't matter. It's just say something and say it out loud.
Yeah. So we really have to grasp the chance and pick the chance and create a lifestyle which is, well, appropriate for the next generation also. So thank you very much, Sandra, for this talk, for time with you sharing here your thoughts from founding story up to the next future. So that was, for me, very interesting. So thank you for having you here.
Thank you, Jule. Thank you.
Riese und Müller Unplugged, the podcast for everything that gets us in motion. If you want to hear more, be sure to listen to our other episodes.